At the end of May 1870, the 8 creaking and complaining wagons left Jacksboro, throwing clouds of dust so high that Comanche scouts well to the north were assured that the convoy was underway. It was attended, the Indians quietly noted, by only 7 cavalrymen, 4 blacks in front, 2 at the rear, and 1 white officer riding slowly back and forth to maintain communication. It was not an orderly procession, nor a compact one, because each driver, his own boss, and in no way obedient to the army of which he was not a part, chose the track that he thought best, which meant that the line straggled ridiculously. "I'd keep that line firmed up," one of the troopers advised the carters, but they snapped, "You mind your horse, we'll mind our mules." "You'll want us soon enough if the Comanche strike." "That's what we always hear. If... Well, damn it, when they do strike. And we've heard rumors out of Santa Fe. I want these wagons in a quick line." "They've been in line since we left St. Louis." Grierson's men brought the wagons safely to 3 cairns, and when the watching Indians saw that an orderly transfer of responsibility was being made, they faced a problem. "If we attack too soon, the Fort Richardson men may gallop back to help. If we attack too late, men from Fort Garner will hear and come out with support." They were additionally perplexed when the Eastern group, pleased with their work on the plains and loath to ride back to dull garrison duty at Jacksboro, stayed with the Fort Garner men till morning of the second day. "When will they leave?" Matar grumbled, and Peavine had to reply, "Who knows? Soldiers. Whoever knows about those idiots?" That morning, however, the Fort Richardson men retired, rode a short distance eastward, and fired their guns in the air. Some of the shotgun men riding next to the drivers responded. And now Elmer Toomey, a 21-year-old farm boy from Indiana, fresh from West Point, was in command of his first important detachment. He rode at the front, always attentive to the boundless horizon for indication of storms or Indians. At certain periods, only a few trees would be visible, and sometimes he would scan the 4 points of the compass and see none at all. At such times, Sergeant Jaxifer rode slowly back and forth, checking on his 10 horsemen, but never speaking to or even looking at the 16 carters, who were disgusted to think that they were being guarded by niggers. One, a surly fellow from West Virginia, who would have sold half his cargo in Jacksboro had not one of the cavalrymen kept close watch, protested to Lieutenant Toomey, "You keep them niggers well shy of me. You ask me, we fought on the wrong side in the Civil War." "They're soldiers of the United States Army," Toomey said stiffly. "I'm an officer in their company." And the carter sneered, "The more shame for you." "Attention, you bastard. One more word like that, and I'll have you in the guardhouse when we get there." The driver, knowing that he could exercise no control over him, laughed. "Little boy, don't play soldier with me. Now run along and nurse your niggers." An hour after dawn on the next day, this driver shrieked in terror, "Comanche, where in hell's the army?" 16 unreliable carters and 11 enlisted men, led by an untested lieutenant, were suddenly responsible for holding off more than 100 Indian braves on terrain that afforded no protection. But they were not powerless, because the black cavalrymen were toughened professionals, and their white lieutenant was about to prove that he more than deserved his rank. "Wagons form," he shouted, personally leading the tail wagon toward the head of the line and showing the others how to place themselves. "Sergeant Jaxifer, keep your men inside the line of wagons." When carters were slow to obey, he threatened to shoot them, and before the Indians could strike, he had his band in the best defensive position possible. But even so, they were not prepared, not even the black veterans, for the fury with which the Comanche struck. From his command post, Matark ordered, "Circle them. Set them on fire." His entire contingent formed a huge circle around the wagons, his braves wheeling counterclockwise as they preferred, for this enabled them to fire across their steady left arms as they sped. But as the battle waxed, a cadre of 14 braves bearing lighted brands detached themselves from the circle and dashed boldly at the wagons, trying to throw their flame so as to ignite the canvas covers. Six fell from their saddles, shot dead, but the other eight delivered their fiery brands, which the carters extinguished. Inside the ring of wagons, no orders were issued, for these embattled men required no exhortation. Each was aware of the terrible tortures he was going to undergo if he lost this fight, and each resolved that there would be no surrender. This was a fight to the death, and several wagoners muttered to their friends, "If they come at us, at the end, I mean, shoot me." The eight carters who rode shotgun knew how to use their weapons, and the eight drivers, shaking with fear, also fired with determination, with the early result that the Indians were kept some distance from the wagons. 11 now lay dead before the first member of the convoy had been seriously wounded. Toomey stayed mostly with the panicky drivers, and he was furious when the mean-spirited men began to blame their plight on the fact that black troops had been sent to protect them. "Damn niggers, don't know nothing," one man growled as he fumbled with his gun, which had suffered a minor jam. "Niggers is no better than Injuns. Curse 'em both." Toomey said nothing, interpreting the ugly expressions as signs of nervous fear. But he did what he could to reassure the civilians. "My men know how to hold a line. We'll get out of this." Jesus Christ. One of the carters pointed to the north, where a line of at least 40 shouting warriors came in solid phalanx. "Hold your fire," Toomey cried, knowing that Jaxifer would have his own men in readiness. He then called for two of the troopers to help him defend the spot at which the oncoming force seemed likely to hit, and there he stood, heels ground into the sandy soil, as if he intended never to be budged. The Comanche were so determined in what they expected to be their final charge that despite heavy losses to the steady fire of the black troops and the trained shotgun men, they simply rode down the defenders at two points, the victorious braves in the lead galloping right through the circle, where mules attached to the wagons lay dead. But they did not stop. They were not given time in which to rampage inside the circle, because whoever tried was either shot or clubbed down by the troops. They had broken the line, as they were determined to do, but they had not disorganized it, and they had lost many in the attempt. They did, however, succeed in taking with them a good portion of the horses, and had not the mules drawing the wagons been left in harness, they too would surely have been stolen. The men of the 10th Cavalry were now on foot. Toomey was appalled to see his horses go, but he knew that he must not display either fear or consternation, lest the civilians panic. "Sergeant Jaxifer, your men in good shape?" "Fine, sir." Indeed, the cavalry veterans were handling this battle as if it were a parade ground exercise. They were not impeded by the loss of their horses, for they had learned that in a dozen typical engagements, they would in at least 10 be expected to fight on foot. Said critics, "They ride comfortably to battle, dismount and become infantry. Why in hell aren't they infantry in the first place?" Such critics were about to receive the best possible answer, but before it manifested itself, the Comanche organized another frontal assault, and this time they directed it specifically at where the surviving drivers stood, for their clever fighters had detected this to be the weak spot of the circle. Toomey, seeing them come, stood beside the drivers, and once more twisted his heels to dig them in. But when the Indians struck, he was powerless to hold them off, and he was tomahawked twice. His head was split open, and his left arm, with which he tried vainly to defend himself, was nearly severed. Jaxifer was now in control, and he was ruggedly determined to save the remnants of this escort. But when he started to tell the carters how they must arrange themselves to be most effective in the charges that he knew would soon come thundering at them, they refused to obey his commands. "No nigger tells me what to do." He did not respond. Instead, he said slowly, "Two carters, one cavalryman. That way we can cover the space better." "Don't you touch me, nigger." "You must move to that weak spot." "I ain't taking no orders." Sergeant Jaxifer stopped, smiled. "Man, we gonna survive this. They ain't gonna ride us down, never, but we got to do it sensible. You been in this one fight, I been in 16. I don't lose fights, and I ain't gonna lose this one. Now fill those gaps." After thus disposing of the survivors, he threw a blanket over the corpse of his lieutenant. But even as he did so, a terrible pain struck at his heart. He knew that as long as he remained in the service, he would be remembered as the black sergeant who had lost his white commander. During the fight so far, no member defending the wagons had seen Chief Matarque, nor could anyone have been aware that a white man was helping direct the fight. But had the defenders been told that such a man was hidden behind the first small hill, they would have guessed that it was Amos Peavine, for the rattlesnake's reputation had reached all the forts. He was the Comanchero they despised, but also feared, and the men of this train would not have been surprised to learn that he was again trying to steal army guns for sale to his Indians. At 9:30 that morning, Peavine was counseling Matarque, "Wear them down. Send your men in from a different direction each time. How soon will they surrender?" Peavine did not want to tell the chief that the behavior of the Comanche toward captives made it unlikely that soldiers would ever surrender, or carters either, so he dissembled. "By noon we'll have the wagons. The next charge I lead." Peavine did not like this at all, for he had often observed that when a great chief died, the problem of succession could become messy, with the friends of the old chief suddenly the enemies of the new, and he did not like to speculate on what might happen to him if, on this lonely plain, Chief Matarque perished in a fruitless attack which he, Peavine, had recommended and helped organize. It was in his interest to see that Matarque lived, so he counseled against participation in the charge. "You are needed here." "I am needed there," Matarque growled. And when the charge began, directed at a spot with three fallen horses, he was in the lead. Again, his men ripped right into the circle, and again the stubborn black troops, with their fiercely effective gunfire, drove them out. But Matarque had seen the diminished strength of the defenders, and now he knew for certain that their officer was dead. "By noon, we take the wagons." And this would have been a safe prediction, except for the cautious behavior of two men who were not yet engaged in the battle at Three Cairns. Hermann Wetzel never slept well if even one of his soldiers, infantry or cavalry, was absent from any fort to which he was attached, and he had been attached to many. His stubborn German conscience and his love of Prussian order hounded him if any man was not safely accounted for. Furthermore, the absence of Toomey made him most uneasy, for the young lieutenant was untested and operated under two severe disadvantages, which led Wetzel to interrupt his breakfast and hurry over to Reed's quarters. "It's a short ride in from the cairns, and Toomey's a good man. But he's cavalry, and they never know tactics, and his men are niggers, and they don't know anything."
"None of that, Colonel."
"I'm still worried, sir, very." Reed had put down his knife and fork, arranging them meticulously beside his plate.
"I'm concerned, too. What do you recommend?"
"I'd send troops out to intercept them. The Comanche have been silent for too long." Reed, a man who never flinched from hard decisions, looked directly into the eyes of his German advisor. "I think you may be right, Colonel." And as soon as these words were uttered, he leaped from the table, rasping out orders for an immediate formation of the remainder of Company R, 10th Cavalry, to intercept the incoming train. Of the company's authorized strength of 80 troopers, only 68 had been sent to Fort Garner. Of these, one had deserted, 17 were on guard duty or in the hospital, and 12, including young Toomey, were already at Three Cairns. Thus, only 38 answered the muster call. He would lead, of course, for whenever there was a likelihood of action, he insisted upon being in the vanguard. Wetzel, who disliked serving with the cavalry, would remain in charge at the fort, which he could be depended upon to defend, should the Indians strike when the others had been lured away. Isolated forts were sometimes endangered, but not when Captain Wetzel was in command. Reed wanted to take Jim Logan as cavalry officer, but the Irishman was absent on a scout, his men said, and when Reed checked quietly, he learned that Mrs. Miner was absent, too. But for the moment he decided to do nothing about this. "Colonel Miner, you will be second in command." And then, with that second sight which made him an able commander, he added, "Full campaign issue."
Miner deemed it folly to carry full battle gear on such a trivial excursion, considering the abundance of supplies this involved. But he assumed that Reed wished to test his men, so he said nothing. And within 18 minutes of having made his decision to intercept his young lieutenant, Reed was headed east with Miner and 38 Buffalo soldiers. He posted scouts well in advance, of course, but they could find only remnants of Toomey's march in that direction and no sign whatever of Indian activity. However, one of the ragged older men who served the army, a tracker with one-quarter Indian blood, elected to ride well to the north, from where he returned with ominous news. "General Reed, 100, 200 Comanche headed east, maybe 6 days ago." Now it was clear. Chief Matark had made a most daring move. "Colonel Miner, he's going to attack the wagons between here and Jacksboro." He was inclined to start immediately at full gallop, but his innate caution directed him to consult his subordinate. How could he be trying to trap us, Miner? He could be fainting, then attack the fort. Colonel Wetzel can handle that. How about us? If he tricks us eastward, what gain to him moves us closer to the wagons? Bugler? A muted call, which could be heard only yards away, was sounded, and the force of 38 blue-clad troopers spurred their horses into an easy trot. They had gone only a few miles when another scout reported the news which Wetzel had intuitively feared. "Major battle. Hundreds of Comanche." Without halting, Reed shouted his tactics. "Half left, half right. But the moment we spot where their command is, everyone straight at it. Ignore the wagons." When they reached a rise from which they could see the embattled wagons and the Indians assaulting them, Reed ordered his bugler to sound the charge. With Miner and the black cavalryman at the gallop, they rushed to join the battle. Reed's men behaved with precision, his group following him in a circle to the north, with Johnny Miner's horsemen riding swiftly to the south, where they picked off several stragglers. At the far end of the circle, they joined, then wheeled about to face a main charge of nearly 80 Comanche. It was a mad struggle, lasting nearly 10 minutes, but in the end the blue-clads were driven back to the wagons, where steady fire from the circle supported them. It now became a melee, not a battle. Many Indians were killed, and 5 of Reed's men. Miner was badly wounded, taking a bullet through his left hip, but the circle remained intact as the charge of the Indians wavered and then broke. The attack on the Cavan and Clark wagon train at Three Cairns had failed. 31 Indians and 9 defenders lay dead, but the fight was over. When Reed learned that Toomey had died, he went to where the body lay, drew aside the blanket, and saluted. "He died bravely, I'm sure." "That he did," one of the carters said, "but I'm bringing charges against them damn niggers. They let us down." Reed did not listen, and a few moments later one of the shotgun men came to him. "That big sergeant, none braver. He held us together." "I'd expect him to," Reed said. Reed now faced a series of difficult decisions, which he proceeded to make in rapid-fire order, as if he had long contemplated them. First, he had to know his exact strength. "Sergeant Jaxifer, your condition?" "Started out with Lieutenant Toomey and 10 men. Toomey and 3 dead, 3 wounded. 5 effectives, including myself, sir." Reed turned to Corporal Adams, who had ridden with him. "Started with you, Colonel Miner, and 38 men. 5 dead, Miner and 3 men wounded. 31 effective, sir." Reed studied the situation for less than 10 seconds. "Our immediate job, get this valuable train safely to Fort Garner. Our permanent job, catch Matark before he leaves Texas." To the horror of the C&C carters, he assigned the 6 wounded Buffalo soldiers and Corporal Adams to escort the train on the remainder of its journey. This, of course, brought wild protestation from the carters, who wanted the entire force to lead them to safety. Reed listened to their protests for about 20 seconds, then drew his revolver and summoned Adams. "Corporal, if this man gives you any trouble, shoot him." He rode to the 8 drivers, looking each in the eye. "Men, you've brought your wagons this far. Finish the job." To the 8 men riding shotgun, he said, "My men couldn't have held them off without your fire. Keep it up." With an icy smile, he tapped one of the loaded wagons. If you should need more ammunition... He turned on his heel and paid no further attention as the C&C men organized their wagons for the limping journey to Fort Garner. His job was to pursue Matuck, but with Corporal Adams gone, he had only 34 men, including himself, to do battle with the much larger Comanche force. But this disparity gave him no trouble, for if he had with him no fellow officer, he did have Sergeant Jexifer, who was a small army in himself. With such men, he could give the retreating Comanche a lot of trouble. So, 20 minutes after the battle at Three Cairns ended, Reed was in foolhardy pursuit of Chief Matark and his many Comanche, and not one of the black horsemen who followed him was apprehensive about overtaking the Indians, or fearful of the outcome if they did. They got the men, but we got the guns. The chase continued for a day and a half, but when it looked as if the cavalry, with its superior horses and firepower, were about to overtake the Comanche and punish them, another act in the great tragicomedy of the plains unfolded. For when Reed and his men threatened to overtake the Comanche, the latter simply turned north, reached the Red River, swam their horses across, and found sanctuary in Camp Hope, administered by the Pennsylvania Quaker Earnshaw Rusk. Under the specific terms of General Grant's peace policy, the Army was free to discipline the Indians as long as they operated in Texas south of the Red River. But the moment they crossed north into Indian territory, the Quakers were in control. Specifically, no soldier could touch a Comanche, and certainly not fire a gun at him, so long as he was north of the river and under the protection of Earnshaw Rusk. As soon as Reed saw Matark and his men fording the river, he knew he was in trouble. But ignoring it and his official directives, he followed them across, and with all his men cantered into Camp Hope, demanding to see the agent. The Indians, now dismounted and almost beatific in their innocence, smiled insolently as he rode past. "Agent Rusk, I'm Captain Reed from Fort Garner. I've heard the warmest reports of thee, Captain. I've come to arrest Chief Matark of the Comanche." "That thee cannot do. Matark and his men are in my charge now, and as the terms—" "I know the terms, Mr. Rusk, but Chief Matark has just waylaid a supply train and killed 10 American citizens, including 8 soldiers under my command." "I'm sure there's been a mistake in thy reports," Rusk said. "And I'm sure there's not, because I personally counted the bodies." "It's thy word against his, Captain Reed, and we all know what thy soldiers think about Indians." "Will you surrender Chief Matark to me?" "I will not." "Will you allow me to arrest him, then?" "I forbid thee to do so." "What am I allowed to do?" "Nothing. Thee controls south of the Red. I control north, and it's my duty to bring these Indians to peaceful ways." So the two Americans faced each other, the blue-clad soldier representing the old ways of handling Indians, the homespun Pennsylvanian farmer representing the new. Reed was a Baptist who believed that God was a man of battles, a just judge administering harsh punishments. Rusk, a Quaker, who knew that Jesus was a man of compassion, who intended all men to be brothers. Reed trusted only army policy: harry the Indians and confine them to reservations. Rusk believed without qualification that he could persuade Indians to move willingly onto reservations, where the braves would learn agriculture, the women how to sew, and the children how to speak English. Reed interpreted his task as clearing the land for occupation by white ranchers, and then protecting them and their cattle from Indian raiders. Rusk saw his as helping both the white newcomer to the land and the original Indian owners to find some reasonable way of sharing the plains. In fact, the only thing upon which the two administrators agreed was that the West should be organized in some sensible way that would permit the greatness of the American nation to manifest itself. They even looked as dissimilar as two men of about the same age could. Reed was not tall, not heavy. He wore his dark hair closely clipped and affected no mustaches. He stood very erect and spoke sharply. His eyes were piercing and his chin jutting. By force of unusual character, he had risen in the Union Army, from being a conscripted teacher from a small town in Vermont to a generalship in command of an entire brigade of troops. He loved the order of army life and expected to obey and to be obeyed, an attitude which manifested itself in all his actions. He looked always as if ready to step forward and volunteer for the most difficult and dangerous task. By the sheerest accident, he had stumbled upon the one career for which he was best suited, and he proposed to follow it with honor as long as he lived. Earnshaw Rusk was a gangling fellow whose unkempt hair matched his ill-fitting clothes. He had such weak eyes that he disliked looking directly at anyone, and his voice sometimes cracked at the most embarrassing moments, as if he were beginning a song. His Quaker parents had trained him never to press an opinion of his own, for Quakers tended to reach decisions by unspoken consensus rather than through exhibitionist voting. But he had also been told that, when he felt he was right, to forge ahead without let or hindrance. He had never been sure what those words meant, but he did know from observation that it was fairly difficult to dislodge a believing Quaker from a position morally taken, and he saw no reason why he should be different. "Agent Rusk," Reed said, as if launching a new problem, "you and I share a most difficult responsibility." "We do." "Now, you are harboring in your camp." "We harbor no one, Captain. We provide a home for Indians on their way to civilization." "This time you're harboring a fiendish killer, Chief Muttark of the Comanche." "I know, Muttark. I cannot believe—" "Have you ever heard of the Bear Creek Massacre?" "I've heard the usual ugly rumors people spread." "Have you ever heard of the little girl Emma Larkin?" "I don't know that name." "At Bear Creek, Muttark massacred 15 men, women, and children, and he massacred them most horribly. Would you care to hear the details?" "I am not interested in soldiers' campfire tales." Reed did not hesitate. "When you and I find the little girl, and we will, believe me, Agent Rusk, we will, we'll see that her ears and her nose have been burned off. We'll find that she's been raped incessantly. She'll probably be pregnant, but we'll find her." Rusk blanched. "I find such stories repulsive." "They are," Reed said. "But in this case, they're real. I found the bodies, hacked apart. I reassembled them as best I could. I buried them." "That's a terrible charge for thee to make on a guess." And there the struggle intensified, for Rusk's continued use of the biblical thee seemed to be parading his virtue, as if to say, "I am more Christ-like than thee. I am of a higher moral order." This infuriated army men, for they interpreted his pacifism as the behavior of a simple-minded man who could scarcely differentiate dawn from dusk. Reed, having sworn not to lose his temper with this difficult Quaker, smiled icily. "I am not guessing, Agent Rusk. I know." "Thee is being terribly unfair to Chief Muttark." Impulsively, for he was a good man, striving to protect other good men, he sent for Muttark. And within a few minutes, the three protagonists who would compete for Texas rights so desperately faced one another. Muttark appeared as if he had come from a pleasant hunt, his features in repose, his body at ease. It seemed doubtful that he had ever committed an act of warfare, let alone massacre. But Reed noticed that he did stay close to Rusk, as if he realized that this man was now his appointed protector. "This is my friend Chief Muttark," Rusk began. And he expected the two men to shake hands. But Reed refused to touch the Indian. "Chief, Captain Reed tells me that thee attacked supply trains." "Lies. Lies. He has men out there to prove that thee attacked the train. Black soldiers whose reports we can trust." "Must have been Kiowa. No Comanche. None." When the interpreter translated these words, Rusk smiled thinly and held up his hands. "Thee sees, I was sure it must have been other Indians. We have great trouble with the Kiowa, chiefs like Satanta, Satank. Matark's Comanche were nowhere near Three Cairns? No, never so far south. We hunting Indians, not fighting. We stay on reservation. Reed did not respond to this. Suddenly he asked, What have you done with Emma Larkin? Matark stiffened, a fact which Rusk noticed, then said, Kiowa killed her people. We rescued her. She's safe with us. Reed bowed his head, visualizing what safe meant in such situations. Rusk noticed this, too, and asked, It is true that thee holds a white child? And Matark replied, For safety, to keep her from the Kiowa. Even Rusk could see the cynicism of this response. Any white child held captive by Indians should be returned to white protectors. And if the child was a girl, the obligation was doubled. For the first time since he came west, this peace-seeking Quaker experienced a grain of doubt about the goodness of his Comanche. But he raised no questions, because he honestly believed that Matark was an innocent man, vilified by the rough soldiers at Fort Garner. Rusk still did not comprehend the terrible problems faced by white settlers in Texas, and he refused to admit that his Indians ever raided down in Texas and then found sanctuary a few miles to the north in the Indian Territory. Reed and Matark understood each other. With them, it was a duel to the death. And if Matark had had just a little more time the other day, he would have captured one of Reed's wagon trains and killed every soldier guarding it. On the other hand, if Reed had been able to keep the Indians south of the Red River for one more day, he would have tried to annihilate them. It was brutal, incessant warfare, and each man wondered at the naivete of Agent Rusk, who did not comprehend this. Captain Reed accomplished nothing at Camp Hope except his own humiliation, which he accepted silently. But on his return to Fort Garner, he felt he must, as a responsible commanding officer, broach a subject which threatened to undermine the effectiveness of his troops. He summoned Logan and began cautiously. Were you able to speak with Colonel Miner when they brought him in? Very bad knock in the left hip. 2 minutes, 3 minutes. As you would expect, he was smiling. Very good man, Miner. He performed well at the cairns. You'd expect him to. He'll be a long time mending. Perhaps we should send him home. He wouldn't like that. He asked me to assure you. Reed had to wonder whether Miner had actually said that, or whether Logan was merely endeavoring to keep Nellie Miner close at hand, and he judged that now was the time to be frank. Major, Johnny Miner is going to have a rough time with that hip. He'll need all the support he can muster, from his wife especially. That is sure. I'd take it kindly, Major, and so would Mrs. Reed, if you saw less of Miner's wife. Yes, sir. No more was said, and Reed told his wife, I think the matter of Nellie Miner has been settled. And Mrs. Reed said, Thank God, these things can get so out of hand in a lonely fort. This one was far from settled, however, for even if her lover was willing to cease the affair, Nellie Miner was not. And one morning, after dressing her husband's suppurating wound, she mounted a horse and rode far out to the tank, where she had insisted that Jim Logan meet her. They allowed their horses to wander into that glade where the Indians had observed them before the attack on the wagon train, and there they renewed their passionate love. When they lay looking up at the endless blue sky, Logan said, The last time. I can't make love to the wife of a wounded comrade. You damned men, you know he cares nothing for me. He did, and now he needs you. Need, need. That's all I hear. I need things, too. Mrs. Reed, who learned quickly of Nellie's brazen escapade, was not disposed to have this headstrong young woman wreck her husband's command by some act that would be reported to Washington. Fort Garner had already been marked unfavorably because of the loss of men in the attack upon the wagons, and because Reed had allowed Matark to reach sanctuary across the river, and one more unfavorable notice might be decisive. She therefore summoned both Nellie and her lover to her rooms in the commander's building, the second on the base to be converted to stone, the hospital invariably being first. And there she presented them with surprising information. "I have consulted with the surgeon from Fort Richardson, and he at first warned me that Colonel Miner was too weak to be moved. So I had to bide my time and let you two run wild." "We have not," Nellie tried to break into the speech, but Mrs. Reed ignored her. "But now your husband is mending, Mrs. Miner, and I am asking that he be taken from here in an ambulance tomorrow. And my husband is recommending that when he is recovered, he be assigned to desk duty with Lieutenant General Sheridan in Chicago. You will accompany him when he leaves this fort." Logan felt that he must protest. "There is no cause for such dismissal." "Mrs. Miner is not being dismissed. She is merely accompanying her husband, as a good wife should." "But especially when he has been wounded in a gallant charge against the Comanche." She was implacable in her opposition to this adulterous pair, and had taken the precaution of informing others, before the meeting took place, that the Miners were being shipped out, and had arranged that the ambulance which would carry them away be brought to the rear of the hospital, where its wheels and fittings were being checked. So when Johnny Miner's lady and her Irish lover left the commander's quarters, everyone on the base, even the black cavalry privates, knew that they were in disgrace. And since her reputation could degenerate no further, Nellie went boldly to the stables, where she asked one of the cavalrymen to saddle her horse, and upon it she rode toward the tank. Moments later, Logan, in disregard of the punishment that must surely be visited upon him, rode after her, and the fort buzzed at his arrogant defiance. Even a laundress, who worked sometimes in the hospital as a kind of nurse, felt obligated to inform wounded Johnny Miner of his wife's intemperate behavior. He ignored the gossip, taking refuge in the fact that very shortly he would be rid of Fort Garner and its complexities. But finding no assurance that when his headstrong wife reached Chicago, she would behave any differently. Before Nellie had reached the tank, Logan had overtaken her, and when he saw the extreme agitation which possessed her, he realized for the first time that their lovemaking had become considerably more than a mere escapade. It was now something so important in her life that she could not face surrendering it, no matter what cold New England women like Mrs. Reed said, or what Reed himself might do to protect the integrity of his command. "I won't go to Chicago. I won't waste my life with that cripple." "You'll have to. Can't stay here." "I'll leave the ambulance when we reach Jacksboro. Finish with the army, Jim, and join me there." "And do what?" This was a compelling question, for he was an Irishman, trained only in the care of horses and their utilization in battle. He had not wanted assignment to a regiment of Negro cavalry, but he had accepted because that was the only pattern of life open to him, and now even that frail opportunity was being threatened. "I can't leave the regiment." She sat on the ground beside the gray water and enticed him to join her. And after they had made love, for the last time, he swore to himself, she casually reached across to where his belt lay and took from its holster his heavy Colt's, pointing its barrel at her head. "I think it best if I end this nightmare." "Nell, put that down." He reached out to retrieve his gun, when he saw to his horror that she was now pointing it at him, and with a skill he had not suspected, she was releasing the safety. The last thing he saw was the steel-gray barrel aimed at his forehead, and her finger pressing the trigger. As soon as he fell, she resolutely, and with no regrets, placed the barrel deep in her mouth, its end jammed against the roof, and pressed the trigger a second time.